I to know she hates eggs? All I'm aware of is that she gets neither eggs nor visitors on Sundays. They say Adeline is brilliant, but to me she's rather pathetic, too. Rushing around in that infantile brown dress, looking like a refugee fresh off a junk from the mainland. Never gets any letters either, though she's always first in line when mail gets delivered. I heard Monica say to her yesterday, "Expecting a letter from someone? I wouldn't hold my breath if I were you." Monica is just unhappy she and Adeline will be in the same class next term after the holidays. No brain likes to be upstaged. In spite of how she dresses, I think Adeline will be okay eventually. She has a sort of special spirit, and it's a person's inner core that counts, don't you think? The lunch bell sounded and they scurried off. I waited a while longer, then opened the door a crack to make sure no one was around. Phew, what a relief. The coast was finally clear. In the bathroom mirror, I stared at myself while washing my hands, full of inarticulate emotion. I mulled over Eleanor's secret attempt to pass on her unwanted egg for me to consume, thinking, who am I kidding? The whole world knows of my eggless state, and some even feel sorry for me. No way will I ever allow myself to be the object of anyone's charity or pity. Besides, in spite of everything, is there not a hint of respect in their sentiments toward me? I walked to my cubicle and sat at the edge of my bed after drawing the curtain around me for privacy, then stacked my books beside my flashlight in the bedside locker. Did the sisters know that I frequently read by flashlight under the bedclothes after lights out? Did other 13-year-olds also have terrifying thoughts at night and difficulty sleeping? Were they sometimes besieged by anxiety and nameless monsters of the deep? If so, how did they deal with these paralyzing fears about their future? What was their escape route? I looked down with distaste at my shrunken brown dress, two sizes too small. My refugee costume. Better change back into my school uniform before joining my peers for lunch, I thought. At least my uniform was still the right size. Chapter 19, End of Term. It was the last day of term. Classes had finished, and we boarders sat in the lounge waiting for our parents to take us home for the summer holidays. Eleanor Leigh was wearing her good shoes with the 2-inch heels, examining herself in the mirror and fluffing up her hair. "I must admit, my bangs are rather nice. Even if I say so myself," she announced. "They certainly look better than your legs," replied Monica unkindly, thereby drawing attention to her own slim, well-shod feet. It was true that Eleanor's legs did appear somewhat fat and beefy in comparison as she tottered around unsteadily on her high heels. "The problem is, I love to eat too much," Eleanor said candidly with a giggle. "Remember yesterday when we had a discussion on crocodiles in Ma Mien, Horseface, Valentino's science class? I was wondering how barbecued crocodile meat would taste when Ma Mien suddenly asked me whether crocodiles have lungs. As long as their meat tastes good, who cares how they breathe?" "That's why you are such a marvelous cook," her loyal friend Irene Tan exclaimed. Everything is reduced to a recipe in your head. Do you remember that discussion we had in English class on the word serendipity? We all burst out laughing. Our English teacher, Mother Louisa, had just defined the meaning of serendipity as a discovery by accident of things which one is not in search of. Now, girls, I want you to give me some examples to illustrate this word and make it come alive for the class, she instructed. Rachel raised her hand. How about the discovery of America by Columbus? He was looking for a shortcut to the East Indies when he came upon a whole new continent. Very good indeed. Another example, girls? Last Sunday, my dad was telling me about the Korean War, Daisy Chun said. He read in the newspapers that many badly wounded American soldiers were being saved by this medicine called penicillin. 10 years ago, they would all have died. Apparently, an English doctor in London called Alexander Fleming dropped some mold on a plate of germs and noticed how all the germs around the mold got killed. That's how he discovered penicillin. Completely by accident. This is another excellent example. Now, do you remember last week's lesson on the word galvanism? Can we combine the two concepts, serendipity and galvanism? The previous week, Mother Louisa had said that the word galvanism came from a man named Luigi Galvani, who first noticed a frog's leg muscle twitching when its nerve was stimulated. However, no one knew the answer to her question, because she hadn't mentioned what Mr. Galvani was doing with the frog's leg to begin with when he made his discovery. Eleanor, Mother Louisa finally asked, wake up. Do you have a theory? What is the story about Mr. Galvani and his frogs? Oh, Mother Louisa, gushed Eleanor enthusiastically. Frog's legs are delicious, stir-fried with a little ginger and soy sauce. So tender and juicy. In my dad's restaurant, we have frog's legs and I order them every time. Only they're called field chickens on the menu. Same thing, really. She paused briefly and must have suddenly remembered to whom she was speaking. I think Mr. Galvani was eating frog's legs for dinner. Maybe he bit on a nerve by mistake, and the leg twitched or something. That's another example of serendipity. Mother Louisa arched her eyebrows while the whole class roared. Amazing! So, you have Mr. Galvani chewing on a bunch of twitching frog's legs. She waited for the uproar to die down, then continued. In actual fact, Mr. Galvani was hanging frog's legs by a copper wire from an iron railing at his home. A gust of wind blew the copper wire against the iron railing, and the frog's legs twitched. Without meaning to, he had accidentally created an electric current. This serendipitous event in the 18th century resulted in the discovery of galvanism. One by one, my fellow boarders left, calling out best wishes and happy summer holidays to each other. Eventually, only Rachel Yu, Mary Swen, and I were left behind. Though I felt a special closeness to these two friends, I was never able to openly confide in them anything about my family. Those were emotions I repressed, and thoughts I hated to think, let alone express. Besides, they had their own problems. Mary's father kept a small wife and spent most of his time with his second family. Her mother, though ostensibly his big wife, saw him only on Mary's birthday and Chinese New Year. Neglected and ignored, Mrs. Swen became bitter and quarrelsome. On the rare occasions when Mr. Swen did come home, he and his wife argued constantly. Rachel's parents were separated. Her father, a well-known jockey and horse trainer, saved every penny to keep her at Sacred Heart. She was his sole reason for existence and an investment for his future, but she felt smothered by his expectations. After the hubbub and excitement of everyone's departure, I developed a stinging headache. Even though I had mentioned nothing of my summer plans, all the girls knew I was again the only boarder not going home for the holidays because I had not bothered to pack. It was hard to be the only one left behind time after time, and I couldn't help feeling sorry for myself. Mary and Rachel were probably staying around deliberately for as long as possible to keep me company. Did they sense my mood? I sauntered out onto the balcony, and they followed me. It was getting dark, and lights were coming on all the way down the slope, across Victoria Harbor and into the peninsula. We could see the giant ships dotting the bay below, and well-lit ferry boats moving smoothly to and fro between Hong Kong and Kowloon. I was seized by a longing to escape. "More than anything," I told them, "I yearn to grow up, get out of here, and see the world. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the three of us could sail away together on one of the big boats down there to all those countries we've been reading about? Japan, England, Australia, America. We must get away, stand on our own two feet, and create our own destiny." "Let's make a pact," Rachel said, "that we'll always be there for each other, wherever we may be." Solemnly, the three of us placed our six hands on top of one another and made a giant fist. Chapter 20, Pneumonia. My headache worsened after Mary and Rachel went home and I was left alone. All night long I tossed and turned, feeling hot one minute and cold the next, trying to find a comfortable position. There was a tickle in my throat and I couldn't stop coughing. Next morning, the sight of my breakfast sickened me. It was very depressing to sit in the refectory all by myself, filled with a feeling of déjà vu. In the middle of it, I had a coughing fit and ended up vomiting. When I came back from the bathroom, I coughed up some blood. Mother Mary felt my forehead and told me I was burning up. She ordered me to go to bed and called a doctor. My temperature shot up to 104 degrees. When the doctor came, he immediately admitted me to the hospital. While I was hospitalized, Mary Swen came to see me every day. She was my one and only visitor. Her mother lived within walking distance of the hospital, and Mary told me she had nothing better to do. On one occasion, Father dropped in. Mary saw him because she happened to come into my room while he was leaving. Later, she was able to report to our friends that not only did I actually have a father, but he was also handsome, well-dressed, and looked very important, thus disproving once and for all the widely held belief that I was an orphan. The doctors injected me with penicillin, and I recovered. Father's chauffeur came to fetch me when I was discharged. To my amazement, instead of taking me directly back to school, he drove toward the car ferry terminal instead. "Am I going home?" I asked, half hopeful and half fearful.
"Yes, those are your mother's orders."
Third brother opened the door when I rang the bell.
He had recently arrived from Shanghai. I was overjoyed to see him and had a million questions.
Where is everyone? The apartment is so quiet.
Father is at the office. Niang, fourth brother, and little sister have been invited to a friend's house. Before Niang left, I heard her tell the chauffeur to bring you home, to recuperate here for 1 week. I was greatly relieved.
So it's just the three of us for the time being. Where is Yuya?
He is having lunch.
Let's join him.
I've been waiting for you.
We found Yuya sitting by himself in the dining room, despondently staring at his plate.
On it were some steamed carrots, a small piece of poached fish, a mound of rice, and a few potatoes. His face lit up when I ran to his side and greeted him.
Yuya!
Ah, Umei,
you're home.
I must apologize for not waiting for you to have lunch.
My diabetes is worse,
and this English doctor friend of your father's has put me on this special diet.
He looked down with distaste at his food. I have to eat punctually at 8, noon, and 6. Otherwise, my blood sugar goes sky high. The trouble is, I get so tired of eating the same thing 3 times a day, every day.
He sounded so sad I felt like crying. Instead, I sat down beside him to keep him company and asked third brother,
How is Aunt Baba?
She's fine. Still working at Grand Aunt's bank. She keeps worrying about you and Yuya.
Did the communists bother you?
No. Life in Shanghai is better than ever. Actually, he lowered his voice. I was having such a good time, I didn't want to come to Hong Kong at all. Big brother and second brother left over a year ago to go to college in England. So at home, it was just Aunt Baba and me. She treated me like a king. Life in Shanghai won't be like that forever, Yuya warned. The communists will show their true colors sooner or later. Besides, your father has plans for you to study in England next year. Just like your two older brothers.
How lucky! Oh, if only I could go to college in England too. I'd give anything in the world to be able to do that. Alas, it's not for us girls.
A thought struck me and I continued,
Where is Big Sister? Is she still in Taiwan?
No. Against everyone's advice, she went back to Tianjin with her husband and took their baby daughter with them,
Yuya replied.
Yes, Big Sister is now a mother,
and I have my first great-granddaughter.
What a mistake Big Sister is making in going back to communist China. Mark my words, she'll come to regret it.
What are your future plans? Third brother asked, turning to me.
How are you doing at school these days?
Before I could reply, Yuya said proudly,
True to form, She continues to be top of her class year after year. She started in Form 1 when she first came to Hong Kong. The next year, she skipped a grade and attended Form 3. We just received a letter from Mother Superior saying that they're encouraging her to skip another grade. In September, she'll be going into Form 5. And she's only 13 years old. Not bad, Third Brother exclaimed. You must feel pretty good about yourself. Oh, I don't know. What good does it do? Being top of my class and skipping grades and all that. My friends probably think I'm some sort of freak, reading all the time. Not that it'll get me anywhere. They nickname me Scholar, but I don't know whether that's complimentary or derogatory. I read because I have to. It drives everything else from my mind. It lets me escape to find other worlds. The people in my books become more real than anyone else. They make me forget. It's not so bad here, is it? Third Brother asked wistfully. How can you say that? I exclaimed. But then, you've only just arrived. Besides, you're a son, not a despised daughter, and you have England to look forward to. For me, it's bad. In fact, very bad. To begin with, I have no future. I'm terrified they'll force me into an arranged marriage like Big Sister's just to be rid of me. I don't know what they have in store, but you can be sure it's not England. I've been here for over 2 years, and this is only the third time I've been allowed home. The rest of the time, I'm shut away behind convent doors like a nun. Last time I was home was 5 months ago at Chinese New Year. I was helping little sister with her homework when Niang pointedly told her not to spend too much time with me and sent her away. Who needs it? No one. She treats me like a leper, and I know she doesn't like me. Quite honestly, I don't like myself either. As for father, he doesn't even remember my name. In his mind, I'm nothing. Less than nothing. A piece of garbage to be thrown out. Don't talk like that, Yaya interrupted. You mustn't talk like that. You have your whole life ahead of you. Everything is possible. I've tried to tell you over and over that, far from being garbage, you are precious and special. Being top of your class merely confirms this. But you can vanquish the demons only when you yourself are convinced of your own worth. The world is changing. You must rely on yourself and not end up married off like Big Sister. I have faith in you. Go out there and compete in the most difficult examinations. Create your own destiny. Your Yaya is an old man now. And his days are numbered. Who knows how long we have to talk like this? But no matter what happens, always remember that my hopes are with you. Trust me. Continue to work hard.
One day, you'll show the world what you are really made of. At that moment, Akum entered the room with our lunch. In contrast to Yuya's Spartan repast, she placed sweet and sour spare ribs, string beans with beef and black bean sauce, and sautéed spinach on the table for Third Brother and me. As soon as she left the room, Yuya quickly served himself a generous helping of ribs. "I know I'm not supposed to eat this," he said. "And your father will probably yell at me should he find out. But my doctor has taken all the taste out of my food. Sometimes I ask myself, what's the point of hanging on if I can't even enjoy my meals? What else is there left for me?" There was so much despair in his voice, it made me cringe. I longed desperately to make it up to him. So I said, "When I go back to school, I'll try even harder. And if I should be so lucky as to succeed one day, it'll be because you believed in me." Chapter 21, Playwriting Competition. When I went back to school after a week, the holidays were not yet over, and all the girls were still home with their families. The place was a tomb. Day after day, I sat in the library reading and chatting with Mother Louisa, who also served as the school librarian. In a magazine, I came across an announcement for a playwriting competition that was open to English-speaking children anywhere in the world. Inspired by Yuya's exhortations, I approached Mother Louisa with some trepidation. "Should I enter this competition? Do you think I stand a chance?"
"As good a chance as anyone else. Since you have time on your hands and wish to enter, why don't you? It will focus your energies and give you a goal."
"Because I don't think I'm that talented. I'm afraid of losing."
"Look at it this way. Anyone who enters has a chance. However, if you don't enter, then you certainly will have destroyed your chance before you even begin. First, you must believe that you can do anything you set your mind to. Remember the old adage, genius is 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration."
I sent for information and was tremendously excited when I received by return mail the application form, as well as 4 pages of extremely complicated rules and regulations. That was the only mail I ever got during my entire time at Sacred Heart. Laboriously, I read and reread the instructions and set to work. I titled my play Gone with the Locusts and created the story of an imaginary African girl who was stolen from her parents by bandits during a famine brought on by locusts. Into her lips I injected my loneliness, isolation, and feeling of being unwanted. To my heroine I gave everything of myself. What began as a diversion became a passion. In the end, I had her triumph over her adversities through her own efforts. I enjoyed my task so much that I was almost sorry when it was completed. "This play is dedicated to my grandfather," I wrote proudly on the cover sheet, and sent it off the day before the girls came back from vacation. School restarted, and I was in the 5th form. Though I wrote many letters to Father and Nyang begging them to allow me to go to college in England with Third Brother, they never replied. In fact, they seemed to have forgotten me entirely. When they moved into a bigger house, I was never told,
but discovered it by serendipity. During Christmas vacation, I was helping Mother Mary sort out a bulky pile of mail addressed to the sisters. To my amazement, I came across a card sent by my parents. Besides holiday greetings, Joseph and Zhang Yan informed the nuns of their change of address. Instead of Boundary Street in Kowloon, they were now living on Stubbs Road in Hong Kong. Of course, they had not thought it necessary or worthwhile to write to me. Chinese New Year's came and went in 1952 without any contact from home. There was also no news about my play, even though 6 months had gone by. Mother Louisa consoled me. "Be patient. No news is good news. As long as you don't hear, you can keep on hoping. Pray hard. Miracles do happen."
"If I win, will you inform my Yaya? He'll be so pleased. He really believes in me, and I dedicated my play to him."
March 1952. I was playing basketball and the score was close. I lowered my head and lunged toward the basket, eluding my defender by suddenly switching to her left. I found myself free and took careful aim.
"Adeline!"
Ma Mien, horseface, Valentino, was calling me. I shot the ball anyway and watched its arc as it sailed through the air and through the hoop. Swish! 2 points! The score was tied. For once, I didn't miss.
"Adeline, come here at once."
"Oh, Mother, can we please finish our game? 5 more minutes. Please?"
"No, Adeline, this can't wait. Your chauffeur is waiting for you downstairs to take you home."
"My chauffeur? Am I hearing correctly? Take me home? Have I died and gone to heaven?" There was a hush. All the girls on the basketball court were listening with their faces upturned. I knew what was going through their minds because I was thinking the same thing. Adeline actually has a chauffeur? We were all equally astonished. I left the court and ran to Mother Valentino.
"Go, wash your hands and comb your hair," she said. "There is no time for you to change clothes. Your father has sent his chauffeur to take you directly to the Buddhist temple. Your grandfather has died. Today is his funeral."
I sobbed throughout the long ceremony, besieged by sorrow and loss. No one else was crying. Father, Niang, third brother, fourth brother, and little sister sat stony-faced next to me as the monks chanted endless prayers and extolled Yaya's virtues. The heady smell of incense permeated the air. Between masses of white flowers, I saw my Yaya's kind, sad face peering at me from his photograph perched on his coffin. I heard his voice once more, exhorting me to try my best and create a life of my own. It was because of him that I had dared to enter the playwriting competition. Now he'll never know how much he influenced me. Does anyone else in the world care whether I win or lose? I saw Niang looking at me with open disdain as we filed out and waited for Father's chauffeur to drive us home. I knew I looked ghastly with my dirty school uniform, scuffed and smudgy tennis shoes, straight, unpermed hair, bitten fingernails, and swollen eyes red from crying. Standing beside her made me feel especially worthless,
plain and small. I caught a whiff of her perfume and was sick with fear.
As the Studebaker approached, Nyang turned to Father and announced in a loud voice that I was looking uglier and uglier as I grew older and taller. Hearing this, Fourth Brother gave a snort of contempt. Oh, the misery of it all. I felt I was being skinned alive.
At home, Nyang called me into the living room. She instructed me to look for a job when school ended that summer, because Father had too many children to support and could no longer afford my school fees. She reminded me that I was 14 years old and could not expect to live in luxury at Father's expense forever. After lunch, the chauffeur brought me back to school. It was the free interval after tea, and my fellow boarders were playing a game. Rachel screamed out,
"Join us! What, in your opinion, is your best physical, intellectual, or social feature, Adeline? Each player first writes her own notion on a sheet of paper. The rest of us then put down their views for comparison."
As we progressed, it was illuminating to see how differently my friends viewed themselves and one another. One by one, without realizing it, we each revealed our inner beings. We went down the list alphabetically. Daisy, style versus sincerity. Eleanor, hair versus lips. Mary, legs versus hands. Irene, eyes versus friendliness. Rachel, intelligence versus generosity. Because I had come in late, I was allowed to go last. It was my turn. My paper remained blank as I thought desperately, do I have any redeeming features?
"Come on, Adeline," Rachel prompted. "Write something."
"Okay," I finally blurted out. "Here it is." Rachel opened my paper.
"What's this?" "You wrote nothing. What does that mean?"
"That's right. Nothing. I don't think any of my features are good. That's what I mean."
"And that's your honest opinion of yourself?" Rachel asked.
"Yes. That's it. Everything is ugly. I loathe myself."
"Well, we beg to differ. In fact, we have voted you most likely to succeed."
The combination of Yoya's sudden death and Nyang's instructions to leave school and get a job sent me into a horrible depression. Night after night, I was unable to sleep, worried about my future, wondering what was to become of me. I spent hours praying in the hushed solemnity of the school chapel, trying to figure a way out. I dreamed of running away and sneaking back into mainland China, rejoining Aunt Baba and my school friends in Shanghai. I wrote numerous beseeching letters to my parents, begging them to let me go to England, where my two oldest brothers were studying. "Third brother is leaving for London in August," I wrote. "May I please accompany him? I do so yearn to go to college. I've skipped 2 grades in the last 3 years, and am still at the top of my class. I know I'm only a girl and don't deserve it, but will you please be so kind? I promise I'll pay you back as soon as I graduate and get a decent job." During the day, I was unable to eat, but spent hours gazing at the harbor below, dreaming of a time when I could escape and sail away to fabulous institutions of learning far, far from home. Every afternoon at tea time, I waited in line when mail was distributed, hoping for a letter from home. It was a standing joke among the girls that I was always there waiting, though I had only received one single letter in my 3 years at the school. Not from home, but from the playwriting board. Still, I couldn't help being there every day. The idea of leaving school forever in a few months enveloped me in a constant state of gloom. Without the prospect of furthering my education, my dreams were withering, and I was in agony. Day after day, anxiety spun its web around my thoughts and spread to all corners of my heart. Time went by relentlessly, and it was Saturday again. 8 weeks more, and it would be the end of term. In my case, perhaps the end of school forever. Four of us were playing Monopoly. My heart was not in it, and I was losing steadily. Outside, it was hot, and a warm wind was blowing. The radio warned of a possible typhoon the next day. It was my turn, and I threw the dice. As I played, the thought of leaving school throbbed at the back of my mind, like a persistent toothache.
Adeline!
Ma Mien Valentino was calling.
You can't go now, Mary protested. For once, I'm winning.
1, 2, 3, 4. Good. You've landed on my property.
$35, please.
Oh, good afternoon, Mother Valentino. We all stood up and greeted her.
Adeline, didn't you hear me call you? Hurry up, downstairs. Your chauffeur is waiting to take you home.
Full of foreboding, I ran downstairs as in a nightmare, wondering who had died this time. Father's chauffeur assured me everyone was healthy.
Then why are you taking me home? I asked.
How should I know?
He answered defensively, shrugging.
Your guess is as good as mine. And they give the orders, and I carry them out.
During the short drive home, my heart was full of dread, and I wondered what I had done wrong. Our car stopped at an elegant villa halfway up the hill between the peak and the harbor.
Where are we?
I asked foolishly.
Don't you know anything? The chauffeur replied rudely. This is your new home. Your parents moved here a few months ago.
I had forgotten, I said as I got out.
Akum opened the door. Inside, it was quiet and cool.
Where is everyone?
Your mother is out playing bridge. Your two brothers and little sister are sunbathing by the swimming pool. Your father is in his room and wants to see you as soon as you get home.
See me in his room? I was overwhelmed by the thought that I had been summoned by Father to enter the Holy of Holies, a place to which I had never been invited. Why? Was I to be forced into an arranged marriage? Timidly, I knocked on his door. Father was alone, looking relaxed in his slippers and bathrobe, reading a newspaper. He smiled as I entered, and I saw he was in a happy mood. I breathed a small sigh of relief at first, but became uneasy again when I wondered why he was being so nice, thinking, is this a giant ruse on his part to trick me? Dare I let my guard down?
Sit down! Sit down!
He pointed to a chair.
Don't look so scared. Here, take a look at this. They're writing about someone we both know, I think.
He handed me the day's newspaper, and there, in one corner, I saw my name, Adeline Junling Yen, in capital letters prominently displayed. It was announced today that 14-year-old Hong Kong schoolgirl Adeline Junling Yen of Sacred Heart Canossian School, Cane Road, Hong Kong, has won first prize in the international playwriting competition held in London, England, for the 1951-1952 school year. It is the first time that any local Chinese student from Hong Kong has won such a prestigious event. Besides a medal, the prize comes with a cash reward of 50 English pounds. Our sincere congratulations, Adeline, for bringing honor to Hong Kong. We are proud of you. Is it possible? Am I dreaming? Me, the winner? I was going up the elevator this morning with my friend, C.Y. Tung, when he showed me this article and asked me, "Is the winner Adeline Junling Yen related to you? The two of you have the same uncommon last name." Now, C.Y. himself has a few children about your age, but so far none of them has won an international literary prize as far as I know. So I was quite pleased to tell him, "You are my daughter." "Well done." He looked radiant. For once, he was proud of me. In front of his revered colleague, C.Y. Tung, a prominent fellow businessman also from Shanghai, I had given him face. I thought, is this the big moment I've been waiting for? My whole being vibrated with all the joy in the world. I only had to stretch out my hand to reach the stars. "Tell me, how did you do it?" he continued. "How come you won?" "Well, the rules and regulations were very complicated. One really has to be dedicated just to understand what they want. Perhaps I was the only one determined enough to enter, and there were no other competitors." He laughed approvingly. "I doubt it very much, but that's a good answer." "Please, Father," I asked boldly, thinking it was now or never. "May I go to college in England too, just like my brothers?" "I do believe you have potential. Tell me, what would you study?" My heart gave a giant lurch as it dawned on me that he was agreeing to let me go. How marvelous it felt simply to be alive. "Study?" I thought. "Going to England is like entering heaven. Does it matter what you do after you get to heaven?" But Father was expecting an answer. "What about creative writing? After all, I had just won first prize in an international writing competition." "I plan to study literature. I'll be a writer."
"Writer?" he scoffed. "You are going to starve. What language are you going to write in? And who is going to read your writing? Though you may think you're an expert in both Chinese and English, your Chinese is actually rather elementary. As for your English, don't you think the native English speakers can write better than you?"
I waited in silence. I did not wish to contradict him.
"You will go to England with third brother this summer, and you will go to medical school. After you graduate, you will specialize in obstetrics. Women will always be having babies. Women patients prefer women doctors. You will learn to deliver their babies. That's a foolproof profession for you. Don't you agree?
Agree? I thought. Of course I agree. Apparently, he has it all planned out. As long as he lets me go to college in England, I'll study anything he wishes.
How does that line go in Wordsworth's poem?
Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive.
Father, I shall go to medical school in England and become a doctor.
Thank you very, very much.
Chapter 22. Letter from Aunt Baba. 22nd September, 1952. My precious little treasure. What a surprise to hear from you after 4 long years, and to learn that you were on your way with Third Brother to study in Oxford, England. Your letter, postmarked Singapore, gave me more happiness than anything else in the world. The only thing better would be a personal visit from you. Thank you for thinking of me on your long ocean voyage. What an adventure for the two of you. Here in Shanghai, I share your father's big house on Avenue Joffre with Miss Chien and 2 maids. I am tired this evening after my usual long day's work at the Women's Bank. However, I have so much in my heart to say to you that I must write to you tonight. I must confess that I have been much worried about you since we have been apart. Before he passed away in March this year, Yo-Yo used to write and give me news of you. I knew Aunt Wren had taken you from Tianjin to Hong Kong, and that you were in boarding school there. In his last letter to me, Yo-Yo was gravely concerned about your future. That is why it is such a pleasant surprise to learn that your father has agreed to send you for further studies in England. Tonight I miss Yo-Yo more than ever, and that is another reason why I'm writing. Some day you will be my age and may wish to speak to me, but I may no longer be around. Keep in mind always, always, no matter what, that you are worthwhile and very important to me, wherever I may be. When you were little and things were going badly, you used to run to me and ask me to take away this big black cloud in your head. Do you remember? I'd tell you a story, and you would fall asleep listening. Here is a new story I want you never to forget. Whenever you feel discouraged and those clouds come back, take out this letter and read it again. It is a message from your Aunt Baba, who will always hold you precious in her heart. This story was told to me by my own mother, your Nainai, many years before she passed away. It is part of our Chinese folklore. Once upon a time, there was a little girl called Ye Xian who lived during the Tang Dynasty in China. Her father had 2 wives and 2 daughters, 1 by each wife. Ye Xian's mother died, followed by her father. Her stepmother mistreated her, showing preference for her own daughter. Ye Xian was a talented potter and spent her time at the wheel perfecting her skill. People came from far and wide to purchase her pots. Her only friend was a goldfish, which she loved. Her stepmother became jealous, caught the fish, and ate it, hiding the fish bones under a pile of manure. Ye Xian found the bones and hid them in her room. The presence of the fish bones gave off magical rays that imparted a special sheen to her pots. A great festival was being held, but Ye Xian was forbidden by her stepmother to attend. After her stepmother and sister left,
Yixian dressed herself in a beautiful cloak of kingfisher feathers and a pair of gold shoes that were light and elegant. At the festival, she spoke briefly to the local warlord, who was much struck by her beauty. Her stepmother recognized her and gave chase. Yixian ran home but lost one of her shoes, which was found by the warlord. He ordered all the girls in his kingdom to try it on, but it was too small. The cobbler who made the shoes came forward and told the warlord of Yixian, who had traded one of her pots for the gold shoes. Through her own talent and effort, Yixian had bought the shoes that led eventually to marriage with the warlord. They lived happily ever after. In England and America, your grandaunt tells me there is a similar story called Cinderella. In a way, both Yixian and Cinderella are like you, children who are mourning for their dead mothers. Their stories may be perceived as talismans against despair. By winning that prestigious international playwriting competition, you have climbed another rung on the ladder of success. Like Yixian, you have defied the odds and garnered triumph through your own efforts. Your future is limitless, and I shall always be proud of you, my Chinese Cinderella.
The End. You've been listening to Chinese Cinderella, The True Story of an Unwanted Daughter, by Adeline Yen Ma, narrated by Felice Ye. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.